an average day, around 190,000 flights come in and out of Heathrow. Today, there'll be an extra 47,000 flights, a record. Stretched baggage handling staff are processing items including canoes, pole vaults, and javelins. There's been concern over long lines at passport control and the inability of the game security contractor to supply sufficient staff. Yet, London Mayor Boris Johnson remains upbeat.
London is as ready, in fact, readier than any Olympic city has ever been at this stage in proceedings.
The Olympic Village opens its doors today. It's accommodating 16,000 athletes and officials. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
And I'm Paul Brown. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, who believes smart listening and smart banking go together. Learn more about Ally Bank at allybank.com.
Support comes from the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, hosting the 2012 Grassroots Radio Conference, July 26th to 29th in Urbana. The conference brings together media artists, organizers, radio operators, and citizens to learn, discuss, and brainstorm. More information and registration is at grassrootsradioconference.org.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind we will not be taking calls.
We have been told that to be great is to be bold, that the happiest people are the most sociable people. Our guest, author Susan Cain, says that that may be why so many introverts hide from themselves. As a personality trait, she says introversion is seen as something between a disappointment and a pathology. And that is a perception she is out to change. This morning, in this hour of the show, we will be talking with Susan Cain about some of the ideas that you will find in her new book. And the title of the book is Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Crown is the publisher. Susan Cain is a writer whose work on introversion and shyness has appeared in the New York Times and also PsychologyToday.com. She has taught negotiation skills at corporations, law firms, and universities. She's also practiced corporate law for 7 years. She's joining us this morning by telephone. And Ms. Cain, hello.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. You know, this morning, as the topic came up in our newsroom that I was going to be talking about introversion, the first question everybody wanted to know was, well, what exactly do you mean by that? So maybe that would be a good place to start. How do you define introversion?
Yeah, and it is a hard thing to define because, you know, there are as many definitions of the term as there are personality psychologists, and nobody can completely agree. But I think that we can boil it down to this one thing that's very helpful, that most psychologists would agree with. The difference between an introvert and an extrovert, it's a question of how you respond to stimulation, including social stimulation. So introverts tend to prefer lower amounts of stimulation, you know, kind of quieter, low-key environments, and that's where they feel at their best. They feel most alive, most switched on in those modes. Extroverts are the opposite, and they really crave large amounts of stimulation. So this is why, you know, people often assume when you're talking about introversion that you mean somehow misanthropic or antisocial or not social, and it's really not that at all. It's just a question of preferring to socialize differently, you know, so you'd rather have a glass of wine with a close friend as opposed to going to a big party full of strangers, because the glass of wine with the friend is a much less stimulating thing to do. So that's where you feel at your best.
And it seems to me that I think that people equate being introverted with being shy. And one of the things I think that you argue is that, in fact, those are really two different things.
Yeah, they really are. Shyness is about being afraid of how other people are judging you. So, you know, a shy person would have a lot of trouble with a job interview or going on a date or that kind of thing. Whereas introversion is, as I said, it's just this preference for a kind of quieter existence. Now, in practice, the two overlap to some extent. So there are plenty of introverts who are also shy, but there are plenty of introverts who are not shy at all. And so that's important to understand. And, you know, I think a good example of that kind of person, somebody like a Bill Gates, is said by many to be an introvert. You know, he's a private, reserved, quieter kind of person. But you don't get the feeling that he's overly fazed by what other people think of him.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to be the kind of guy who would become very anxious if he had to address a large group of people.
Right, exactly.
You know, the other thing that's interesting this morning here, this was I was in a room with my colleagues, so the subject of introversion came up. And as I said, right away, people said, well, what exactly do you mean by that? Except then when a random survey was conducted, 4 out of the 5 people said, yes, they thought they were introverts. So clearly they seem to have some idea what it was we were talking about. And then, of course, that becomes very ironic when you think about what we all do for a living, that here all these people are broadcasters and they're admitted introverts.
Well, this is such a funny thing. You know, I've now been speaking to a lot of radio broadcasters because my book came out in January 24th. So since then, you know, I've been talking to a lot of people on the radio, mm-hmm. and I have found that more than 50% of them, I would even say it's like 75%, have said that they're introverts. And that seems surprising at first, but then when you think about it more deeply, it's not so much, because one of the things that psychologists have found about introverts is that the way they tend to approach conversations, they're really good listeners and they're very good askers of questions. And, you know, this develops kind of early on in life as a means of wanting to take the attention away from yourself. You learn to ask questions of the other person. But, you know, what starts out as a kind of strategy in that way ends up becoming just a favored mode of interaction. So, you know, I always find that the people who are conducting, like people like you and others on radio, they're really, really great at asking just the right questions, you know, and at really listening intently and then skillfully directing the conversation in the right direction based on your answer. And all of that is actually an introvert's cup of tea when you think about it.
All right. So it all makes sense that we've all considered ourselves to be introverts. Our guest in this part of Focus is Susan Cain. We're talking about her new book. It's titled Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Crown is the publisher. And again, questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. So I understand that one of the things that got you thinking about this was a time that you spent observing in classrooms and thinking about what are the implications of the move that we have seen more and more in schools to get students working in small groups.
Yeah, well, this is something actually what you're talking about sort of came out of my book research. I was already working on the book, and I knew that I wanted to understand more about the experiences of introverted kids in day-to-day life. And I was kind of starting, you know, from a blank slate with that in a way. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go to visit kids in schools and see what the school day is like for them. And I went to private and public schools in New York and Michigan and in Georgia. And my very first school visit was a public school in New York City, and my contact there was a guidance counselor. And she said to me, you know, nowadays kids are really working in groups. And I had no idea what she was talking about because I'm 43, and when I went to school, that didn't happen. You know, you kind of sat in rows of desks and did most of your work autonomously. And she said, oh, no, it's really different today. So I said, okay, can I come on a day when the kids are doing group work so I can see what you're talking about? And she laughed, and she said, you can come any day. You're always doing group work. And I said, okay, what time of day would you suggest? And she said, any time of day, like really all the time. So I went to the classroom, and I found this completely new system in many schools, not all, but a lot of schools, where the kids are they're sitting in what are called pods of desks of 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 kids, you know, with the desks kind of all facing each other, not facing the teacher, but facing the other kids. And they're doing many of their assignments in group format. And even in subjects like math or like creative writing that you would think you're kind of going off by yourself to dig deep in your own mind. Instead, kids were working in the form of committees, really. And, you know, and I started paying attention to the experiences of the quieter kids in the class, and they often seemed really uncomfortable. Now, not always, because some group work is a good thing, in particular for introverted kids, because it allows them the chance to chat with a smaller, less threatening group of peers as opposed to raising their hands in front of an entire class. But when it's constant group work or when the groups aren't properly managed, you know, it becomes this kind of free-for-all of Lord of the Flies type of social dynamics, which I was observing, you know, it can be really tough for introverted kids. And even for those who are not shy at all, but, you know, just prefer to go off and work independently and, you know, explore inside their own minds, they're not getting to do this nowadays. So this is one of the things I really am trying to call for a rethink here, that we shouldn't do away with group work, that some of it is great, but we need more time in the day for independent thought as well, and for private spaces for kids.
So did some of the interest in exploring this topic come out of personal experience or your own thoughts about how you fall on this introvert-extrovert continuum?
Oh, yeah, very much so. You know, I can remember as far back as when I was really a quite little kid, really having the feeling that the ways that I like to spend my time were different from what was considered the social norm. So, you know, I always had a lot of friends, but I really preferred to play with my friends one at a time and not in big groups. I liked to go off by myself for hours at a time and do creative projects, that kind of thing. I was lucky. I grew up in a family where that kind of thing was considered totally normal. But outside the family, I really observed this difference. And, you know, of course, I didn't have a language for what was happening, but I was very aware of it. And then as I grew older, I actually started out my career as a Wall Street lawyer. And I had an idea when I first started practicing that I was going to be at a real disadvantage because, you know, I thought the ideal lawyer was probably very, like, dominant and bold and gregarious kind of person. And then I looked around once I started practicing and I realized, you know, just as with radio announcers, I realized that more than half of my colleagues were introverts who were using a very introverted kind of constellation of skills to be incredibly effective at what they were doing. And yet there was a bias against this type. So, like, on the one hand, the introverts were sometimes called out and said, you know, you have to be more, you know, go to more of the office parties and more of this and more of that. But on the other hand, they were doing great jobs for their clients. Their clients really appreciated them, you know, precisely because they were really good at focusing and getting the job done, and they were good listeners. And in negotiations, they were really good at creating harmony in the room as opposed to being overly combative. And, you know, and they would help deals to get done. So there's a lot to this way of being that we tend to underappreciate.
Yeah. I think we have to acknowledge that human beings are complicated, so one needs to be careful about reducing them to just some essential bits of personality or tendencies. But having said that, I think you really make the argument that this thing that we're talking about here, where one falls between these two poles, is really very important. And we can think of this as being really essential aspects of personality.
Yeah, you know, first of all, on the one hand, I really agree with what you say about, you know, you can't get too reductive about this. Yeah. And even Carl Jung, the psychologist who popularized these terms back in the 1920s, even he said, there's no such thing as a pure introvert or a pure extrovert. He said such a man would be in a lunatic asylum. So, yeah, you know, don't get too reductive. But on the other hand, I have come to believe that these orientations, you know, that the tendency to be either inwardly or outwardly directed, it's as fundamental a part of our identities as our gender. You know, it really, like, it affects every aspect of our lives. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to start a conversation about it, because we have bookshelves full of texts about gender, and we talk about it as a, you know, a crucial part of what happens at school and at work, and we don't do this with introversion and extroversion, and we need to, I believe.
Well, you know, and I mentioned how just earlier we had this conversation among my colleagues about, well, what is this we're talking about? And then someone said, well, let's have a show of hands of all the introverts. Well, 4 out of 5 of the people in the room said that they were introverts. And if, by the way, anybody is not sure what they are, you can go to Susan's website and there's a little quiz that you can take that will help you decide if you don't know. But all of that goes to this question. Well, do you think, in fact, most people know themselves well enough to say where they fall on this scale?
You know, it's funny. Before I started researching the book, I would have said, yeah, you know, sure, people have a sense of themselves. But I found that that's not true, particularly in the direction of, there are a lot of introverts who think that they are extroverts until they start thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's because from such an early age, we are all sort of coached to act pretty extroverted. So you can get to the point where you feel like that's who you really are until you take a moment to think. You know, what I always ask people is, if you could spend your time exactly as you please, you know, if you could spend your work days, your weekends doing exactly what you want, would you be spending it doing more introverted things or more extroverted things? And when you ask that question, people often start to realize, you know what, I would be I would be doing quiet stuff. I would be on my own a lot more of the time than I actually either allow myself or am allowed by my life circumstances to do.
Well, we have to make the point that what we're talking about here, as Dr. Young said, was a continuum.
Yes.
But having said that, I'm sure that psychologists have tried to make some determination on where most of the population falls. Can one, in fact, say really, let's say, strong introverts, what percentage of the population would qualify?
Well, strong introvert, it's funny, I don't know that there are studies that look at it exactly that way, but the latest study found that half of Americans are introverts, which to me seems high, but that is what the study found. Mm-hmm. Other earlier studies had found it was a third are introverts. There was also a study recently that found that among the younger generation that kids are getting more extroverted, or at least in the way they present in these studies. There's also then the genetic question, like how many people are born or predisposed to be introverts or extroverts. And there is a particular temperament that about 15 to 20% of people are born with that doesn't always, but really predisposes them to be introverted.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating. You know, you can see babies as early as a few months old behave really differently if they're born with this temperament. It's basically a temperament that predisposes you to be more sensitive to your environment, more sensitive to novelty. So if you show one of these babies, a mobile or a toy that they've never seen before, they will often like thrash their arms around very vigorously in a way that a baby who's going to be more extroverted would not do. And that's just because they're reacting more to new stuff in their environment.
Yeah. So that's what, and I'm sure that you talk to parents and you ask them about their, you know, what they thought their children were like when they first met them, when they were the littlest.
Nice way of putting it.
And that I'm sure that many, many parents would say, yes, there is, I could tell you what kind of person they were and that they were going to be right from the very beginning, that there are certain qualities that just seem to have come with the package, and that's it. So that would indeed make you wonder whether there is something genetic. And I suppose that, you know, people have tried to identify genes associated with, say, adventurousness, you know,
right,
that there's something
right.
genetic in the person that wants to go climb Mount Everest or
right.
the person who wants to know what's over the next hill. And I guess you can make the argument, if there weren't at least a few of those people, that human beings never would have gone anywhere if there wasn't somebody who wanted to go
absolutely.
To the next hill. But that it does make you think that, in fact, it may be that there's something that aspect of the person's personality that they just come with.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny. The psychologist who discovered these temperaments that I was talking about, his name is Jerome Kagan, and he's one of the great developmental psychologists of the 20th century. And he actually started out his career in a period where people really believed that there was no such thing as a genetic inheritance for personality, and that people really were just purely shaped by their environments. It's hard for us to imagine now, because nowadays there's so much talk about genetics, but several decades ago it was exactly the opposite. And he says that he was dragged kicking and screaming by his data to start to believe in the genetic underpinnings of temperament.
And it also, you're inclined to think that maybe there's something like that going on there, or at least that there should be a strong role when you look at the data that comes from studies of non-human animals, because these kind of tendencies, that is the tendency of the outgoing individual and the reserved individual, and the tendency of someone to just sort of hang back, take everything in, kind of think about what's going on, and then the other tendency is the person who just the individual who just rushes right in
right,
to the new
right.
situation. That those tendencies, those behavior tendencies, you see them in other animals.
Oh, absolutely. This is one of the most fascinating things to me. You see them in almost every species. I mean, all the way down to the level of fruit flies. Like, literally, there some fruit flies are called by biologists sitters, and others are called rovers, you know, because the sitters tend to sit still in one place, and the rovers tend to go roaming around, you know, as far as fruit flies will roam. And, you know, it's thought that the reason that so many different species have evolved in this way is that the two types have really different survival strategies. And in some cases, the more, quote, introverted animals do better. And in other cases, the extroverts do better. And the same thing, of course, is true with humans.
We're certainly open for questions, comments from people who are listening. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We're talking with Susan Cain about her book, Quiet. It's about introversion, and the questions are welcome. And one of the things that you will find, I think, if you go to the website and take the introversion quiz, one of the questions that you're asked is, are you the kind of person who likes to think before you speak? And I just would like to honor here a quote that somebody sent in by email, paraphrasing Mark Twain, who apparently said, "Better to remain quiet and appear ignorant than open your mouth and remove all doubt." spoken as a true introvert, I think. So at any rate, other questions are welcome. 333-WILL and toll free 800-222-WILL. I mentioned, and I was quoting from some of the materials at the book in the beginning, where I talked about this idea that some people think that introversion falls somewhere between being a disappointment and a pathology.
Yeah.
When at some point did, in fact, psychologists, people who think about personality, decide that being introverted was at the very least a disadvantage?
Well, you know, this really actually started pretty early in the 20th century, which is also when the field of personality psychology was born in the first place. So, you know, the psychologists didn't even think so much in those terms until then. But the birth of personality psychology coincided with a new stage in American culture where we were moving from what historians call a culture of character to a culture of personality. So what happened was, until the 20th century, you know, we were mostly living in small towns, in an agricultural economy. People were working alongside neighbors they had known all their lives. And so this was a period where, when we thought about what we valued in other people, we mostly valued, you know, their moral rectitude, and were they good people? What was going on in their inner lives? Like, did they do good deeds for others when no one was looking? But then suddenly in the 20th century, we now had this culture of big business, and people were moving to the cities, and they had to stand out among strangers who they'd never met before, you know, in situations like job interviews and paying sales calls. And so that was when we entered this culture of personality, where we started to admire people for being really good social performers, you know, and being very magnetic and charismatic. So this was happening in the culture in general, and that's when we started to have movie stars who we admired because they were great guides to how to be a charismatic person. But, you know, it also affected psychology, too. So, in fact, right around this time, I think it was in the 1920s, a psychologist by the name of Alfred Adler introduced this new concept of the inferiority complex. Do you have an inferiority complex or don't you? And that idea, that phrase, the inferiority complex, became all the rage. It was like all over the media, and all famous people were analyzed to determine, do they have an inferiority complex or not? So there was really this idea that, you know, being very bold, being very confident, being very out there was the new way to go for this new age. And really, you know, it's 100 years later now almost, but we're really still living with that cultural inheritance today.
Well, and it strikes me as that there's something, there strikes me as something particularly American about that, but I'm not sure that that's really the case. Maybe it is a modern industrial world kind of thinking and not so much American, because I would expect that in many other places you would find that same idea, that the bold, outgoing person, they're the person that's going to be successful, or those are the qualities that you really need to be successful.
Well, you know, it's true of Western societies in general that there's always been this tendency to favor action over contemplation. It was even more true in the United States, though, because in the U.S., you know, part of the U.S.'s self-identity was to break off from Europe, and there was a kind of idea that the Europeans were these intellectuals, and, you know, that we were kind of leaving behind a languid aristocracy of people who would sit around and think all day long, whereas the Americans, in contrast, were the doers. So it's more intense here. But the real contrast is between Western cultures and Far Eastern cultures, maybe a little less so today as the cultures are becoming more Westernized. But traditionally, Far Eastern cultures have really admired people who were more silent and more reserved. You know, there's an idea in these cultures that that words get you into trouble, and that the person who speaks too much doesn't have self-control, that they're saying things that could get them into trouble, that could hurt other people's feelings. You know, and this is born out of a much more collectivist group identity, where what's important is creating harmony within the group, and then it becomes very important for no individual to stand out too much by being too loud or calling too much attention to themselves. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the West, we have obviously a very different, more individualistic orientation, which seems in a way, because it's individualistic, like it would be more celebrating the introvert. But in terms of actual personal styles of conduct, our individualism meant that it was the squeaky wheel who would stand out and call attention to themselves that became admired.
Mm, that's very interesting. Well, we have a caller here. Let's bring them into the conversation. Someone who is in Effingham. This is our line number 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David. I'm one little comment to begin. Your guest should go back to the Greeks and the Romans and
yes.
celebrity and all that sort of
yes.
thing. And the Romans, you know, they were great on killing each other as a spectacle. But my question for you is, have you ever heard of the German psychiatrist Wilhelm Reich?
Actually not. I'd love to know why you mention him.
Well, his writings, and I have not gone through it, it's extensive, and I'm getting through it very slowly, but his comments about character analysis, and you know, I heard you mention that a bit ago, you know, that the character formation in a given environment and how that affects the recipient of that, and then how they respond into the world that they emerge into, such as school.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for some of it starts at 3 years old, and then the parental, and I'm not speaking of the nuclear family, but now the extinct communal family, where the child received a great deal of his character construction in a group setting.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to one now that is isolated. And I remember my own life. I'm an old man, but I never forget my first trip to school and all the events. I don't remember learning what I understand from those experiences, but I have it embedded in my memory about the social conflicts that evolved out of the mass gatherings of public school. Well, that being as it is, and then the character that is formed thereby, and then how that evolves even more, and this goes back, clear back, I think, to the beginning of male dominance and the mass murder among the same species, which I think is, there are things happen in nature. And that's all about, as I mentioned last week, the evolution of sex and food and how that begins to play out and the deviance that evolves out of that. Well, if you might want to comment on what I've just said, and especially, you know, the things that we have been experiencing for 10,000 years and the evolution of war and mass murder that takes place there. Thank you.
That's an awfully big subject. I don't know if you have some thoughts about that or how what you do connects with that.
Gosh, I not so much the connection to the mass murder going back in evolutionary history.
Well, let me ask you is something else that comes to my mind because of the listener's comments. I wonder, has someone looked at this aspect of personality and drawn any conclusions between a single single kids, big families, people who do grow up in large groups, or people who, relatively speaking, grow up maybe just with them and their parents, and they maybe have one or two very close friends. Does any of that seem to play into the formation of the personality in terms of either being introvert or extrovert?
You know, it's a good question. I haven't seen those studies, which doesn't mean that they don't exist, because the literature on this is just so vast. What I can say, though, is that, you know, for people who are born with a temperament that predisposes them one way or the other, the way we were talking about, you know, there's still a pretty wide envelope of outcomes within that temperament. And those outcomes seem to be shaped to some large degree, obviously, by what happens in your environment, your social environment, your family environment. So the psychologist Elaine Aron actually talks about kids who are born with a more careful, more sensitive temperament who grow up either in the large family, large happy families that you're talking about, or just in very happy sort of social environments, like maybe in some kind of a very close-knit community. And those children, you know, they retain the sensitive aspect of their temperament, but they tend not to be as introverted in the classical sense of the word. You know, they need to go off by themselves, but they also have a great need for lots of social life because they've learned from a very early age to associate that with something very positive and very safe. So, you know, a kind of guideline for all this is that somebody who's born with the temperament of, let's say, a Bill Gates is never going to turn into Bill Clinton. You know, you don't totally go from one side of a spectrum to another, but there's still a pretty wide range of who you can become.
In this hour of focus, we're talking with Susan Cain. She's a writer whose work on introversion and shyness has appeared in the New York Times and PsychologyToday.com. She's worked as a corporate lawyer. Her new book is Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, and Crown is the publisher. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I want to go back to this idea that we really celebrate, we have a way of celebrating extroverts, people who are really outgoing and really out there and have bold personalities and seem to have a great deal of confidence in themselves. And we celebrate those kind of people, whether they're performers or they're athletes or they're entrepreneurs. It seems that we have the idea that that's what it's going to take to succeed. What's interesting is, though, if you go out looking for people who have really been important figures in culture, particularly people who have been creative and really have broken new ground in whatever they do, a lot of those people are, in fact, introverts.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, in fact, just last week I was speaking at the TED conference, which is this a big conference in California where people gather who have been really, many of the people in the audience, let me back up. It's a conference that is devoted to having speakers with ideas that they would like to spread and, you know, to see gain hold in the culture. And many of the people who attend this conference are CEOs or company founders or creative in one way or another. And I gave a talk on introversion, and, you know, it was a funny thing. After I was done talking, people were coming up to me all week long, people who had been in the audience, and wanting to tell me about their own struggles with being an introvert in an extroverted world. And we would talk for a while, and then I would say, you know, what do you do? And invariably, these people had, you know, they had founded companies, they had come up with amazing new inventions. Like, these were incredibly, not just successful people, but people who are really contributing, like, in deep creative ways to our society. And they were introverts. So there's a real misperception, as you're saying. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that I wanted to look at in the book. You know, I profiled a number of people. For example, Steve Wozniak, who invented the first Apple computer. And if you look at the creative process of many of these people, you know, they're working in solitude. So they do come to the point of their process where they are exchanging ideas with people. And the idea exchange often happens even before the actual creative moment. So there is an exchange of ideas. There is an advancement of ideas with other people. But the actual kind of hard work of creativity often happens when the person goes off by themselves to a quiet place where they can kind of be uninterrupted inside their own minds. And it's this solitude, this importance of solitude that I think we're losing sight of nowadays. And, you know, it was interesting. I looked at this both from the point of view of individual histories. You know, like if you look at Steve Wozniak inventing that first Apple computer, he did it alone late at night in a cubicle at Hewlett-Packard, where he happened to be working at the time. So it was a very, very solo process until he then came together with Steve Jobs to collaborate and then form the company, Apple. So that's sort of the anecdotal story of it. But if you look then at psychological research, there's all kinds of interesting stuff about what solitude means. You know, it turns out that you actually cannot be in a group of people without instinctively mimicking those people's opinions. And this is true even about things that would seem to be really personal, like who you're attracted to. You end up aping other people's beliefs and opinions and attractions without even knowing that you're doing it. So, you know, the only way to really know what's inside your mind and explore those boundaries is kind of by definition to go off by yourself.
We have a caller, and we'll get them right here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I have two questions that I'd be interested in what you think. One is, do you take your introverted and extroverted definitions from Carl Jung, who I understand initiated those terms? And the second one is there any way you could know how it divides in terms of the population? Like, is it 50-50? And I was listening to you talk off air. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure. So in terms of the way it divides, the most recent study says it is 50-50. And then there have been other studies that have found kind of a third introverts and two-thirds extroverts. So what I always like to say is it's kind of one out of every two or three people you know is an introvert. That's a good rule of thumb. And in terms of where I take my definition, I start with Carl Jung, but there's been he was active during the 1920s, 1930s. Since then, there's been a huge, fascinating, tremendous amount of research in this field. So I've also spent a lot of time looking at what contemporary psychologists have been doing. Hmm. And when I talked at the beginning of my definition of that it has to do with stimulation, that's a definition that I don't think Carl Jung would disagree with, but it's also based on more contemporary research too.
And that was earlier this morning we had our conversation about, well, what is this all about? I think that was the one that I managed to reach for, and I think that that's actually a better, more nuanced kind of way of talking about what it is that we're talking about. And I think that people can understand that, it's more the idea that, just going back to your example, would you rather sit down and have a nice, quiet conversation with one or two very close friends? Or are you the person that wants to go to the party where there are 100 people and the music is pounding and everybody's all crushed in together and it's a bunch of people that you don't know?
Right.
You know, which of those things would you rather do?
Yeah, and I think it's important to look at it this way too, because when you see it this way, you realize, it doesn't mean that an introvert never enjoys themselves at a party like that. They might. Mm-hmm. It's just that that's not their sweet spot. So probably even at a party like that they enjoy, after an hour or two, they're kind of craving going back home.
Yeah, and also I think it says that there's something a little bit more subtle here, because again, I suppose if you get people talking about what does it mean to be introverted, some people might say, well, that means you really don't like people, but that's, being introverted does not necessarily mean that you're antisocial, but it means that maybe you would just like to relate to one or two people rather than to try to relate to 100 people.
Exactly. And in fact, there's a term in psychology called need for intimacy. How much do you need intimacy? How much do you crave it? And there's no correlation between the need for intimacy and introversion or extroversion. It's really independent of that. And in fact, many of the introverts who I interviewed told me that they were kind of especially attuned to their marriages because they're not drawn to be going out and meeting new people all the time. They're much more focused on the people they know well already. So, it can become a real misconception when people start framing it in terms of meaning antisocial.
All right. Let us talk with somebody else. And the caller is in Bloomington, Illinois, on our line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for this. It's very interesting to me, having, you know, struggled with this for years. I just have a couple of comments, and maybe you have something to say about it. I was intrigued by your information that in a group, people tend to mimic each other, and it scares me today that the groupiness, which often equals conformity.
Yeah.
And I see this in the schools and in groups. I scare myself in groups. I don't do well. But years ago, I studied Montessori, went to California and studied Montessori, and the system of education. And Nancy Rambusch, who brought Montessori to the United States, said that at that time, and this was in the 80s, that we're too groupy. Well, I guess it was late 70s. We're too groupy here, and that one of the basic concepts of Montessori is that the child really cannot, you know, get in a group and share like we want force our kids to do in these tiny little kids until the child knows who they are.
Mm-hmm.
So one of her goals is to help the child develop, you know, know himself or herself. And I just wondered what you thought about that. I guess you agree. I mean, just one more quick thing. That jobs today, interviews, I have one of the, well, there's a lot of information out, that one of the main things today, the main thing, is whether you can get along with the group.
Right.
Yeah, and that is horribly scary to me. Thank you very much. I appreciate this so much today.
Very welcome. And, you know, I think that I have an entire chapter of my book that is devoted to exactly the problem that you are identifying, and it's called When Collaboration Kills Creativity. Because I think, you know, collaboration can obviously be a beautiful thing, but we've made it so sacred that we don't realize what the downsides are and the advantages of solitude. So I have a whole chapter where I talk about, you know, that one study that I just mentioned now, but there are hundreds of others just like it. And I have lots of endnotes in there, so you might be interested in really delving deep. But I'll tell you that, you know, there's one other really big line of research that's been going on for over 40 years now where psychologists look at brainstorming. And they have found that group brainstorming just doesn't work, and that individuals who brainstorm on their own produce more ideas and better ideas than people who are brainstorming in groups. And yet, like, even though the research is so clear on this, and one psychologist concludes from it, he says, you know, businesses must be insane to keep on using brainstorming groups. You know, it's clear when creativity is the highest priority, people should be encouraged to work alone. But we ignore this research and we keep on doing it anyway. And one reason for this that's really interesting is that there is an exception. You know, people who are brainstorming electronically online actually do better even than individuals. And that's interesting to me because that's really what's been happening with the internet, right, for the last 20, 30 years. Whatever the proper amount of time is. You know, we've seen these amazing collective creations that have emerged from the internet. And because of this, and that's exactly what the research would predict, because the internet is basically people brainstorming online together. But because of these amazing creations, we've decided that all collective work is a great thing and that that's the best form of creativity. And so we're now applying it in situations that have nothing to do with the online virtual world, and that have to do with, you know, people in workplaces or children in schools. And I think that's a real misapplication. I will say to the caller, and I'm sorry I didn't get your name, I'm really heartened to see, you know, I've been out there talking about this now for the last 6 months or so, and it is striking an incredible nerve. And, you know, I'm hearing from all kinds of people, including people who design office furniture and people who design school curricula. Like, they're really taking note that we need to rethink this a little bit. So I am very optimistic that things might change in the years to come.
We have about 5 minutes left, and I have a couple of callers here. We'll try to get both. We'll try to get both. We'll certainly at least get one. And we'll start with Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. I'm a library and information student, and we do a lot of online courses. And it's very interesting that you were talking about online kind of brings out this quality of that it, I can't describe. It's unlike something that I've had where it's not comparable to classes that I've had where we're sitting down in a group in a classroom. Mm-hmm. The creativity seems to be through the roof. But I do have experiences where also people that are introverts, they seem to understand, oh, you're an introvert, but also this idea that if we talk to an extrovert, like my sister is an extrovert, and she has a really hard time understanding me as an introvert. It's like something she just can't comprehend.
Yeah.
And, you know, but at the same time, when I, you know, when on these online courses, people take online courses because they're introverts. They kind of,
right.
You know, they really tend to thrive in that environment. But the coursework is just really, really great when they work together. And so my question is there this idea that when they're alone, is there some kind of competitive factor that when they're working alone and they're competitive and they're introverts, that they seem to do much better than when they're together? And it's hard to be an introvert and be competitive in a group setting.
Oh, you're saying because if you're a competitive introvert, then you're constantly measuring yourself against the other people in the group, whereas
right.
if you're alone, you're kind of freed from that preoccupation.
Right, and I don't want to be with the group, so it makes me like not want to be competitive in the first place because I just don't want to be there.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense. Whereas when you're alone, you're more just competing with yourself. You know, it's just your own goals that you're pursuing.
Right, and therefore, you know, I am allowed to be much more creative, and I think that a group of introverts, when they're working alone but yet together, like online, why the quality of work seems to be so much better, even though they might be doing the same type of stuff that they would do in a class.
Right. Excuse me. Well, there's so many reasons for it. I mean, one is that when you are in a group of people, even if you're not particularly shy, people do what's called evaluation apprehension. Like, you know, you start worrying basically what other people are thinking of your contribution. So you spend a lot of mental energy thinking about, should I say this or should I not say it? And if I do say it, how am I going to find the best words? And what are they thinking of it? And how should I respond to the way they think of it? You know, and again, this is true of everyone, not just shy people. And in fact, a neuroscientist named Gregory Burns recently did a study where he found that when people disagree with the opinion of their group, you know, when they dissent a little bit, the organ in their brain that's called the amygdala, which is associated with a fear of social rejection, that organ starts to get really active, you know, and he calls this the pain of independence. There's a pain that we feel in taking a stance that's different from the group. And that's very inhibiting, whereas if you're working alone or if you're working online and you can't actually see the expressions on the faces of the people in the group, or you can take the time you need to, you know, sort of type out the thing that you want to say instead of having to say it very quickly, all these things free us a little bit from that pain, and they make us less inhibited.
I see. So can you tell me a little bit, explain the difference of why other introverts can understand what being introverted is like, and we know what it's like to want to be an extrovert, but it doesn't seem like it's reversed. Like, an extrovert just doesn't seem to comprehend an introvert at all.
Oh, I see.
And well, I can give you about 30 seconds to answer that question.
Okay. I'll try to do this quickly. You know, I think because our culture is oriented towards extroversion, we all know more about what it feels like to be an extrovert. It's only recently that we're shining a light on introversion. But I do think extroverts are starting to pay attention, so I am optimistic about that. I by definition, introverts do a lot of what they do inside their own head, and therefore somebody who hasn't experienced it themselves isn't really privy to your processes, because by definition they're more internal, whereas what an extrovert is doing is more external, it's more viewable. You've been observing it all your life because they're doing it right there in front of you. And if an introvert isn't talking, an extrovert, or no one really knows why, you know, it could be 10 different reasons that you're not talking, but you're the only one who knows what's in your own head. So harder for people to learn from it.
We're going to have to stop there. However, if you'd like to read more on the subject, the book you should look for is the book we mentioned. The title is Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Susan Cain is the author. It's published by Crown. You can go to her website or the website for the book, and you can take a little introvert-extrovert quiz. So if you're not sure which you are, you can find out. Ms. Cain, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it, David.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local productions, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, are available on our website anytime you want to listen at will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
In an election year, it's all about getting people, your people, to the polls.
What works to produce votes?
Politicians think they know how, but scientists think they can do better.
Just in the last 5 or 6 years, we've made a ton of progress on how to use psychology in helping people vote.
Perfecting the science of getting out the vote. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Auditory Care Center, an independent hearing care center serving Champaign, Piatt, Ford, Vermilion, and other East Central Illinois counties. Auditory Care Center offers hearing evaluations as well as selection, fitting, and repair of hearing aids at 892-5959 in Rantoul. Support comes from Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting, holding a short-term and medium-term outlook meeting on commodity and financial market results, July 25th at 6 p.m. at the Arcola Community Service Center and July 27th at 7 a.m. at Yoder's in Arthur. Meals will be provided, reservations required. 866-471-2588.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a commodity and futures update, whereas we're heading into the final hours of trading today. Grain and soy futures are holding on to the sharp gains that we've seen since the beginning of the open outcry session as traders continue to price in additional weather premium. Having come back from the weekend and looking at 10-day forecasts, which are calling for above average temperatures and below average rainfall. Forecasts mostly hot and dry weather, and suggests little relief is coming soon as the soybean crop begins to enter its crucial reproductive stage and pod filling stages across the U.S. growing area. Let's go ahead and look at particulars in Kansas City. September wheat now at 876 and a quarter, up 25 and a quarter. March of 13's at 904 and a quarter, up 24 and a quarter. September wheat in Chicago's at 876, up 28 and a quarter. March of 13, 899, up 27. September corn, 768, up 27 and a half. December, 768, up 27 and three quarters. It's been as high today as 778. That would have been a gain of 30